Okay, we are recording. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our monthly Lunch and Leadership conference call here at the Scarlett Leadership Institute. During the call, if you have questions, press star 7 to talk, or if you're paying attention online, you can enter your question and hit send. So at this point, I'll turn it over to the world-famous Joe Scarlett.
Thanks, Tom. Welcome, everybody. We're glad to have you with us. We got a great topic today by an old friend of mine. Before we get into that, though, I want you to set aside Thursday, July 17th for our next call. And our speaker next time will be Jeff Smart, who also happens to be from Colorado, who's a great author on how to hire people and how to select the right people. And his latest book is How to Run Your Team at Full Power. He's really a dynamite speaker and a dynamite author, and he'll be with us. So mark your calendars, Thursday, July 17th, same time. Today's topic is about must-have customers, how to keep your best customers. And our speaker, our guest is Bob Gordman. Bob is a consultant to major retailers, was a retailer for a long time. I've known Bob for probably 15 years through professional associations. And, you know, we're all dealing with customers all the time. So this is a sort of a core topic to everybody in every business. These issues, though, are, I mean, it's as we talk about in so many of these calls, that customer relations is a long-term process. It's not a short-term process, and it involves the right policies, and it involves the right practices, and it involves good listening, and it's about long-term management practices that really make a difference in developing those customer relations. So enough said by me, though. Let me turn it over to our hostess, Mary Fink. Mary?
Thank you, Joe, and thank you, Bob. We're glad to have you with us. In looking at your book, first of all, the thing that I love about it is winning the customer you haven't got. We read so much about keeping the customers that you have, but yours is a little bolder because you're out there actually going after customers that you don't have and going after specific customers. So we talk about must-have customers, or you do. You talk about three kinds of customers: opportunistic, core customers, and must-have customers. So talk to us a little bit about the distinction among those three.
Sure. Well, let's start with core customers. I mean, the core customers are the people that love what you do. They do business with you all the time. They're not always looking for the lowest price, and they simply like what you do in the field that you're in, and they consider you their real first go-to a business. The opportunistic customers are very much the opposite. They're the ones that when you have a deal or you have a special or you have a discount or whatever, you know, again, based on the industry you're in, or they're always negotiating price. They're never satisfied with what you quote them, and they need something lower. These are the people that it's almost impossible to build a profitable business with. And then the third group we call the must-have customers. And those are the people just like your core customers, whether it's demographically that they're similar or psychographically they're similar. Whatever their values are, they're very much like your core customers, and those are the ones that companies need to acquire in order to build a very profitable business. And so our premise is you have to absolutely focus on gaining more and more must-have customers all the time.
Right, because your opportunistic customers eventually will put you out of business, won't they?
Absolutely.
They'll squeeze you dry.
If I can just share a little bit of my experience from Tractor Supply, we learned over the years to really know our core customer demographically, and we studied and studied and studied, and we realized that this customer owned an acre or more of land, and this customer was typically a full family unit, mother, father, and children. They always had dogs and cats. They likely had some other animals. They often had an antique tractor. They usually drove a pickup truck. They were from a variety of different walks of life. They were doctors and lawyers and school teachers and factory workers, and they were white collar and blue collar. But we got to really understand the customer, and as a result, you really know where that customer is and who that customer is. In terms of the really, really core customers, those were the ones who bought animal feed and dog food from us and cat food, and were in every week or every 2 weeks buying this product that the animals were consuming and that those were actually they those were the really root core customers, and you really got to know them very well. And as a result, as you create the right kind of reputation, that they will tell their friends, and more will come in.
Absolutely. So the must-have customers, I mean, I'm not the only one that has them. There are must-have customers for all kinds of businesses and for even for my competitors. So how do I get those away from my competitors? How do I go after them?
Well, I mean, it's really kind of straightforward and simple, and that is these people, there's a reason that your core customers are your core customers, and there's something you do that they really like. So now these must-have customers are very much the same in terms of their what we like to call rules of doing business with somebody. And if you can communicate with these the right must-have customers that you provide what they want better than anybody else, they're going to want to do business with you. Unfortunately, very often, and I know we don't have a whole lot of time today, but most advertising, whether it's the yellow pages or today on the internet with websites or media advertising, is not terribly effective. And it's a generic approach or a humorous approach, which ad agencies always love. But it's not effective in telling the people you want to tell what makes you unique and different and why they really want to be doing business with you.
Right. Because if I want to paint a broad brush, I'm going to put things in my advertising that appeal to everyone, and I really might not want to be doing that.
Right. Or you're going to run, I mean, my background, like Joe's, has been in the retail business. And you see retailers run, 20% off everything. Well, how does a customer know what that means, or how does a customer, that's not a very specific thing. So you're taking 20% off everything, and it's really not very targeted in terms of who you're trying to reach.
Right.
Plus, it brings to in my mind as a consumer, I'm thinking if you're giving 20% off everything in a store, you're ripping me off the rest of the time. I think it's very important that pricing have some integrity to it. And if the customer thinks that you're so bloated in margin that you can take 20% off everything in a store, it raises a question about what's the integrity of the regular price. I know this one of those suit manufacturing companies, or I can't think which name it is, Joseph A. Bank. You know, buy one, get 10 free. You wonder what the world is the real price for things.
I think you kind of know what the real price is in that case. But with my luck, I'm the one that always just bought it last week when everything is 20% off in the store. So there's that as well. And if I'm that good customer, then I'm going to feel a little betrayed. So you talk in your book about market position, and I think we probably understand that, but who creates that position? You know, I think we get carried away and think that the marketers create that position, but it really isn't them. Who is it?
Well, you take all the things that you do, the behaviors you exhibit, and the consumer or the customer sees what you're saying and what you're doing, and they put you in a bucket. In terms of what kind of a company you are. And if you're not carefully tracking what that position is from the customer's perspective, you might believe that you are a unique, special, and important business. But the fact is, you might not be doing anything that is particularly relevant to who you're trying to reach. So, I believe that the customer or consumer actually creates the position or puts you in a bucket based on the behaviors you exhibit.
Exactly. Just like my customers own my brand. It's not my brand. It's the brand that they have decided that I have.
Yeah, just Mary, just as a quick story, that one of my favorite clients of all time, a company I've worked with for over 20 years, is a company called Lincoln Industries. And this is kind of strange. I just told you my background is retail. Well, Lincoln Industries started out as a plating company, a very small one in Lincoln, Nebraska. And over time, they created a unique market position that they can produce large production quantities of technically difficult product. So the business that most platers were in was price, very, very competitive business, tremendous consolidation, a lot of companies going out of business. But Lincoln decided to really take a unique position. Today they happen to be the leader in that industry. And if you see a beautiful Harley-Davidson go by, they do all the chrome on the Harley-Davidson, or those trucks with the monster stacks on it. That's all their product.
Wow.
So they took a business that was consolidating, not profitable, capital intensive, changed that into a very unique position, and have been gigantically successful.
That's a great story. So let's talk about the sweet spot. What is it, and why do I need one, and how do I get one?
Okay. Well, a sweet spot is really what makes you different from everybody else, and not just different, but you've got to be customer relevant. Being different sometimes isn't really good enough. And one of the stories that's in the book, in The Must-Have Customer, is a story about a stockbroker, a friend named Rick Grossman from Canton, Ohio. And what was really interesting about Rick is he got into the stock business and went through the Merrill Lynch school and learned all about it, and then discovered that he didn't like making cold calls, which is pretty unfortunate if you're in that business. So he tried to figure out what he could do that would be different than everybody else. And this was Rick's now retired, so this goes back, 40 years ago. And he figured out that at that time, the people with money were doctors. And if he could reach doctors, then he could build a very successful practice. So that was his unique sweet spot. But what he discovered was his must-have customers were not the doctors, because the doctors were too busy to talk to him. But it was the accountants and the attorneys that served the doctors.
Right.
And those would be the people that when a doctor had some money to invest, they'd say to their, accountant, gee, who should I go talk to? And Rick happens to be a great golfer, so he played an awful lot of golf, built an awful lot of relationships with his must-have customers, and then created this unique sweet spot, which was serving the needs of doctors. And he went on to become, for 15 years running, he was one of the top 10 Morgan Stanley brokers in the world.
I remember
that. Canton, Ohio, by the way.
I was going to say, and the thing that was remarkable about that was that he wasn't in a very large city. He was in Canton, Ohio.
And not a very wealthy city either.
Right, right. So how can I go about, how can I, someone who's new to this, go about figuring that out? Are there some questions that I need to ask or answer?
Well, we're great believers in research. And the customer knows far more about what they want than you do. So it's really going out and asking the right customers, the people you want to do business with. In the case, if you think about Rick and doctors, that's who you want to talk to. Or if you think about Lincoln Industry and technically difficult product, you don't want to talk to the automobile manufacturers, which is commodity product. You want to talk to companies that really appreciate technically difficult product, like Harley-Davidson, who's built their brand around their chrome.
Right.
So first, you have to talk to the right people. You just cannot talk to everybody at random, because you're going to get then a general consensus, which is not going to do you much good. So it has to start out with, who do you want to do business with? And then asking questions like, where do they do that business now? Who's their current supplier? Why do they do business with that particular supplier? What could that supplier do to make them even more important to them? So, it's really pretty straightforward in terms of understanding what they want. But, again, it's got to be very targeted and very relevant to the group you want to do business with.
Exactly.
You started off this by talking about listening to what your customer really wants. And in the retail world of Tractor Supply, We spend a large portion of our time in the stores not listening to customers directly, because they were too far. We couldn't talk to enough, but we talk to employees, talk to our team members who talk to customers all the time, and they simply are filled with information about what their good customers really want. What do they need? What are the issues? What are the products? What are the brands they like? What do they complain about? What products need better instructions? What products do we need a different brand or a different size or a different color? And if you listen to the people that deal with the customers, in our case at least, when there's so many of them, you just parlay that information in total and you get a very good picture of where you should place your efforts and what products would most likely you should add or subtract from your assortment. There's a ton of knowledge in the heads of the people in your organization that deal with customers, and mining that information is one way to really get inside the head of your customer.
Yeah, Joe, also, I think one of the things that's changed rather dramatically in the last 5 years is today almost anybody can do research on the Internet. There's companies like SurveyMonkey, who's the largest of them, where you can basically go in, structure a survey. You can either buy sample, again, depending on the business you're in, you can buy a sample of certain types of customers, and the survey can go to them. Or if you happen to be in a business where you have a good email list, you can just email the survey to those customers.
Right.
And it's very easy to use. It's very inexpensive. And it's just an incredible tool.
In your experience, what kind of response do you see?
You know, that's interesting, Mary. It really depends on the interest of the group you're going to. I spent 5 years with the Gallup organization, so I learned a bit about research there. And what we've learned is that if you're going, just for example, we were doing a lawn and garden strategy for a national retailer, and the survey, everybody had a lot of things they wanted to learn, so the survey turned out to be almost 30 minutes long, which was very long for a survey. But we found out that if you asked people who were interested in gardening about if you took them through the survey, they didn't care how long it was.
Yeah.
They were happy to talk about it. They were thrilled to talk about it. But
they
if
were
you
glad
have people,
you asked.
Right, and those are the people you want to talk to anyway.
Exactly.
I can give you same kind of thing is true with the people that love their gardening. You're going to talk about it. People who love their animals will do the same thing. And if you go to one of our tractor supply stores and you start talking to somebody who owns a horse, they're liable to tie you up for half an hour telling you about all the things about their horse they like and the kind of tack they like and how they feed them and how they exercise them and so on. And the people who are passionate about what they're doing are your best customers and the ones that are most likely to really want to share information.
Right. Let me remind our callers, *7 if you're on the phone or if you're online. Enter your question in the box and hit submit. So I have my satisfied customers, and I probably, especially at the store level or the individual unit level, have a great idea of who they are. And so I find out one way or another that they're also shopping at the competition, and that just sort of deflates me. Why do they do that, and how can I get them back?
Well, people shop at the competition for one of two reasons. Either the competition's doing a better job of serving them, or you're not communicating what you do that's unique, different, and relevant to them. Mm-hmm. So it's really sort of amazing, and we've done, I don't know, maybe 250 or 300 retail studies over time. And it's amazing how little people know about different stores or different companies. And, of course, the management thinks, oh, well, we're spending a great deal of money on advertising, and we're in the newspaper, and we're on TV, and, of course, now all of the social media. It's incredible how customers really focus on the businesses they want to do business with. They develop habits for that. I mean, think about how often you go to a different restaurant. I mean, people typically go to the same places generally over and over again.
Right.
So you may simply not be communicating, and that's why with research you can find out how much do they actually know about you, and do they know, and what they do know, is that accurate? Does that reflect what you're trying to communicate? Because very often the message is wrong.
Correct. And also, depending on what the business is, I may continue to go there because I have a relationship with someone there, or even I feel I have a relationship with that place. And an example for me is Publix. I'm a very loyal Publix customer. I'm very loyal to my Publix. You know, I don't even like the other Publix as much. And it's because I've never had a bad experience in there. I've never run into anyone there that wasn't helpful and kind and walked you to wherever whatever you were looking for was, instead of saying, you know, try aisle 7. So I think we get that feeling about those establishments that we want to do business with, and once we're there, it's really hard to get us away.
Yeah, I think in the grocery industry, that's really a great example, because in the turmoil of the last couple of decades, Walmart has taken a 25% market share nationally of the grocery business, which is really kind of remarkable. And needless to say, there's a lot fewer competitors, but people like Publix have really stepped up and really differentiated what they do with a very, very high service level.
Mm-hmm.
And they have had no effect from Walmart. The same thing is true with, of course, Whole Foods.
Right.
They've created something very different. You know, you think about a sweet spot, Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or Publix. I mean, these are absolutely not just commodity grocery operations. And they've been tremendously successful in spite of a gorilla like Walmart coming in.
Exactly. You make a comment that probably was the one that stood out to me the most, that customer satisfaction does not equal customer loyalty. Just because I'm satisfied as a customer doesn't mean that I can't be lured away, and for, I guess for all the reasons that you've mentioned before. But do you want to speak to that for a minute?
Yeah, that was an interesting one that we learned at Gallup. We used to do, or still they still do, a tremendous amount of customer satisfaction tracking. So you'll see very often you'll get a receipt at a store, Home Depot or any store, and you'll notice it's rather long. And if you read it, you see there's a survey they're asking you to come take, and then you'd get some future discount.
Mm-hmm.
That customer satisfaction, if you just, for example, do a scale of 1 to 10 and 10 is highly satisfied, people who are not at the very, very top of that scale are simply not loyal. So if they're not an 8, 9, or 10, they may be satisfied, and 5 might be the middle, might be satisfied, but that doesn't make them loyal. I mean, I'm a satisfied AT&T cellular customer. The system generally works pretty well. Customer service is okay if I call them. But if Verizon comes along and offers me a much better deal, I mean, I'd switch in a heartbeat, because I don't think that Verizon is any different, or AT&T is any better than Verizon. So you need people that are absolutely loyal. And, of course, the greatest loyalty question is, would you recommend AT&T to a friend?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you really want to track, is loyalty rather than satisfaction.
You're exactly right, and that is such a great example. I have said so many times, if any one of the wireless carriers could get the customer service part right, as opposed to just selling, they would eat everybody else's lunch.
Even stronger would be in the cable business.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
They could ever get the service level right.
Exactly.
You know, you talked about earlier about loyalty and relationships, and I know this is not something you can duplicate everywhere, but Tractor Supply stores are small enough that if when we keep the personnel turnover low, which is what we do most of the time in most of the stores, you can actually learn the names of your customers. And the retail environment, if somebody walks in, you say, "Good morning, Mr. Smith." I mean, that's the kind of thing that creates loyalty beyond belief. And wherever you have the opportunity to learn your customers' names and address them by name, it's like I used to say that then you can charge them 10% more. Not that we ever did, but that interpersonal, that personal greeting is worth an awful lot.
Yeah, I think also if you look at a company, one of the I think greatest success stories other than Tractor Supply ever is Starbucks.
Yeah.
You know, they now have 20,000 units, which is almost hard to believe. But they have built a business based on loyalty, not on satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And if you're a Starbucks customer and you're familiar with their loyalty program, which is now fully integrated across all media, your phone, your computer, it's really the model for the greatest loyalty building probably of anybody in that business.
And a lot of people, when they travel, I mean, talk about loyal, I've got to find a Starbucks. I'm sitting across from one of them. Joe is always, if we're traveling, where's the nearest Starbucks, and we have to go there. So that's the kind of loyalty that you want, that people are going to go out of their way to find you if they can. They want to do business with you that badly.
If people haven't read Howard Schultz's book, I highly recommend it.
Right.
Because it's a real lesson in loyalty.
It sure is. You mentioned something that is probably a foreign concept to a lot of people, and that is firing customers. And I'm a strong believer that sometimes it's a thing to do, but talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think what we've seen with a number of companies, a fair amount of companies, is that they're so desperate to do business and make the sales figures, make the sales plan, they're accommodating customers that are really distracting their business and forcing them to do things, run sales, run other promotions, discount their prices, take back merchandise. I mean, there's just a whole cadre of things. So when you've got customers like that that are distracting you and preventing you from really developing your sweet spot and becoming powerful to a smaller group of customers, you simply have to get rid of those customers. When I started with Lincoln Industries, they had 500 customers that varied in size quite a bit, but went all the way down to somebody coming in with grandma's teapot and wanting it silver plated. By the time we really got done, they had wound up firing 500 customers and had four, and had never been more successful or profitable because they could really focus on serving four really meaningful customers than 500 that required small invoices and accounts receivable issues and just all kinds of distractions. So it's really a matter of staying focused.
It's a great point that you're. It's like getting rid of clutter in your house. If you can get rid of the distractions in your business, then you can focus on what's really important. What do you know what you don't know? And we talk about that. You talk about that in the book. You know, there are a lot of things that we do know, and there are things that we know we don't know, but then there's those things that we don't know that we don't know. And how can we be about figuring that out so that it can help us in our business?
Well, let me tell a little bit of a story, because I think it's one of the greatest examples of this topic. Back 15 years ago, when Jack Welch was running GE, he was absolutely focused on his succession planning, and he realized how critical that was. So he identified four people at GE that could potentially be CEO, and they really set out to groom those people. And when it was over, they selected Jeff Immelt, who's still the CEO. But then the other three, Bob Nardelli, Larry Johnson, and Jim McInerney, were fired. I mean, they were given severance packages and released from the company, even though they were probably three of the top executives, because Jack believed that there would be conflict between these four powerful people.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim McInerney went to 3M, was tremendously successful, and is now CEO of Boeing, and again is tremendously successful, because when you think about General Electric, or a big part of General Electric, and the things that 3M and Boeing do, there's a lot of similarities. And Jim McInerney knew what he knew about the manufacturing business. The other two, Larry Johnson, went to Albertson's grocery stores. He knew absolutely nothing about the grocery business. And, of course, when you're paying a CEO that much money and they've come from a place like GE, they've got to make decisions. They've got to take charge and start doing things. And he started doing some of the things that he learned from Jack Welch, which was like, if you can't be number one or number two in a market, you should get out. Well, that's okay if you're making nuclear reactors and jet engines, but if you're selling groceries, that's not a real good strategy.
Right.
Well, in a very short time, he bankrupted Albertsons.
Right.
And then the third one, Bob Nardelli, went to Home Depot. And powerful guy. And he went in, and what did he do? He didn't know anything about retail, and he was not very good at asking questions. So he went out and started studying Walmart, and he said, well, gee, if Walmart is that successful, if we do more of the things that Walmart does, then we could be successful like Walmart. So one of the things, of course, he did was he started eliminating a lot of full-time positions, replaced them with part-time people that were in high school or college, had no hardware paint knowledge like the full-time people that they used to have, who generally were painters and electricians moonlighting. And he did tremendous damage to Home Depot. And then, of course, ultimately the board took him out and put in somebody else who understood it better and was better than asking questions and turned it around. And today Home Depot outperforms Lowe's, which they weren't when Nardelli was there.
Exactly.
So you've got to ask, I guess to answer your question is, I think the best way to find out is identify people who are really knowledgeable and successful about a job you're about to take, like Nardelli at Home Depot. And ask them a lot of questions. One of my favorites is, can you tell me what I should know that I don't know? And just let them talk.
Excellent idea. I have one more question that I want you to talk about before we open for questions from our listeners, and that is, let's shift the focus now from customers to employees. And you also talk about must-have employees. How do I find those people? First of all, how do I define them, and then how do I find them?
Okay, well, first thing you need to do is you need to understand what you're going to ask them to do. And kind of a real polarized example of that in the retail industry would be Nordstrom's and Walmart. a great Walmart employee is somebody who's very fast and very effective at stocking shelves and moving inventory and replenishing merchandise. That's a great person at a Walmart store because that's what you need to do. The store is designed for self-service, and the better jobs you can do stocking the store, the more satisfied the customer is going to be. By contrast, Nordstrom's is a very high service level store, so you have to be good at personal interaction, very good about understanding what somebody wants because you're serving customers one-to-one. So it's not about stocking shelves, it's about serving customers. So if you understand what your business is and what's critical to your success, you can then find more people and hire people, because some people don't like to talk to customers. Some people love the idea of stocking shelves, you know, they're introverted, and other people are the exact opposite.
Right.
So you simply have to understand what's your sweet spot, what sets you apart in the market, what makes you relevant to the customer, and then hire people that can do that.
All part of a whole package, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It is one simple, complete package.
Comments, Joe?
We had great success, and absolutely right. You've got to have the right people in the right slots. We had great success trying to in hiring our customers, and by hiring a customer, you found people who were generally passionate about the kinds of products we sell. They were passionate about the rural lifestyle, and they tended to fit in very effectively. Plus, it took a lot less training in terms of product knowledge training if somebody was already familiar with the product and familiar with the lifestyle. So, well, you're absolutely right. If you want to sell anything to anybody, it's all about the people, and start with the right people, you have the highest likelihood of success.
Right. And I think sometimes you know that right off the bat, and sometimes you don't, and you find it out, and then you have to deal with it. But if you have that on your mind all the time, then I think it's going to be much easier for you to be successful in that way. What are your questions from our listeners? Star 7 if you're on the phone, and online, enter your question and hit submit. We have one online question, and that is, can people change? If I have an average performing employee, can I make them a must-have employee? Can I somehow or other train that into them, or is it something that they're born with?
That's always a big controversy. The answer to that is, and I know this from research with Gallup, and this research was with millions of people and their success in their jobs, it is highly unlikely that you will teach somebody to do something they're not naturally good at. Now, you could teach them to do it better, but if they're not naturally, just for example, if somebody is not extroverted, and you're going to teach them to smile, there's probably not many more things more difficult than that that will fail 100% of the time.
You're probably right. I believe we have some callers online some callers that have questions. Go ahead.
Hit star 7 and start talking.
Yeah, we got you.
Hi, guys. This is Joe in Kansas City.
Hi, Joe.
And hi, Joe.
Hello there. And that online question was something very similar to what I was going to ask. Is that something that you're always looking for in employees? Is you want to know the position that you're hiring for? Those are the questions you're asking, getting to know that person a little bit in the interview process, and you hire somebody. But if it's not working out, that person does have to be trainable, if you will, and sometimes that is a difficult task to see up front. Some people interview very well and others don't, and obviously those are the easier ones to eliminate in your decision-making process.
Yeah, one of the books that I recommend all the time, I think it's one of the most important books I've ever read, is called Strengths 2.0. And it's written by the grandson of Don Clifton, who was the CEO of Gallup. And he was really the father of doing interviewing to understand the talents of people and putting the right people in the right jobs. And I think it's really very eye-opening to read that book and understand this talent issue and how you maximize it. Because unfortunately, when people get hired and management doesn't do a good job hiring, ultimately these people get fired, which does terrible things to their self-esteem and their resume. And it's really a management failure. I don't think it's a people failure. I think people just get put in jobs that they're not capable of doing.
Exactly. I think
no,
you're exactly right.
No, that's a great
right.
point.
And the other thing is, I think you have to be the more people that can interview, the better. I think sometimes, you know, anybody can have a great interview for 30 minutes or an hour with one person. But if they go through a series of interviews, particularly if they are talking with the people that would be their peers were they to be hired, a lot of times they'll come across a little more genuine, or they'll let their guard down a little. And Joe, I know you've had experience with that.
The more input you get from the more different places, the more enlightening things are. I remember when we were associated with Belmont University years ago, one of their practices was that they would have the staff interview a potential supervisor. And I remember one situation where we had interviewed this potential leader, and everything looked good, and then the staff came along and interviewed him, and they found out he was an entirely different person. So the more input you get, the more likely you are to make the right decision.
Yeah, it's interesting. A good friend of mine is a retired attorney who is with a firm in Washington, D.C. called Winston, and it was a firm with 900 lawyers, and they only hired from the top schools. So they were from Yale and Harvard and absolutely the top schools. And he said to me a number of times when we've had this conversation, he said, you know, the thing that we did the worst in our company was hiring. That we made more mistakes hiring. Now, you're talking about Harvard and Yale Law School graduates, and here's somebody from management saying the worst job we did was picking candidates.
I can't think of anything worse than 900 bad hires in a law firm. What other questions do you have? I believe we have one more on the phone.
Star 7. Hello.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
Scott McWilliams here. How are you?
Hello, Scott. We're doing great.
Good. I had a question. You touched on Net Promoter Score, and you talked about the value of those customers that are clearly beholden to you, the nines and tens. My question is what I refer to as the agnostics, the six, sevens, and eights. How do you turn them into promoters?
Well, I think if there's six, sevens, and eights because what you do doesn't hit a hot button with what they want. In their view, you're just okay at what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So changing that is pretty difficult. You have to change your business. I guess one way to do that would be to change your business so that it is more compelling to them. Of course, you then have to know are the changes you might make less important to other people. So it's really kind of waiting. If you do a study and you find out that you have an awful lot of sixes and sevens, you really got to think about the sweet spot you're in and the uniqueness of your business and how do you make it more compelling if the majority of your customers are not wowed by you.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you have the opportunity to speak to your six, sevens, and eights, the fact that you're asking the question can help to build a little bit of loyalty and may be able to figure out there what is their sweet spot, and you may be able to get there with very little effort and maybe just tweaking a few things that will move them from six, seven, and eights up to nines and tens.
And that's good, Joe. Just as a follow-up, and I think one of the things we struggle with is on the Net Promoter Score, which we survey all our customers with Net Promoter Score, is depending on who you're interacting with on the client side, you may get a nine or a 10 from a CEO or a CFO, but a much lower score from kind of the day-to-day operational people. And I think that's something we struggle with as a company, is trying to get a comprehensive score that really reflects the health of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Bob, do you have any suggestions for that?
I think is a critical concern is who's the decision maker, because sometimes the CEO and CFO may not be the decision maker. They might be important that you've got a relationship with them, but if it's the people down at the mid-level that are making the buy decision, obviously it becomes critical that they are, you know, totally satisfied with what you're doing. So I think you really need to understand where the contact points are, and how do you, you know, how do you address those?
I think you also have to know where the disconnects are, because if I'm the head of the company and I've got a great relationship with the head of my client company, and yet things are not going well at the level of the people that are actually doing the work or bringing in the product, there's a disconnect there, and I need to know as head of my company how things are going, and so does the other head of the company. Other questions?
Thanks, Scott.
We have one online question. You talked about rules before, Bob. Are there different rules for different customers? Is there a different rule for each set of customers, or do you generally just figure out what your rules are going to be, and that's who you are?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the again, using retail as the example, many retailers believe they make the rules. So they have a return policy, and they have a sale price policy, and they have all these policies, and they make the rules. Well, the fact is, I believe the reality is the customer makes the rules. And you either have to play by the customer's rules, or the customer will find somebody else who wants to play by their rules. So you trying to just use your own internal thoughts, or, you know, I would like to talk about eight guys in a room, you know, that decide mm-hmm. what's important. You really have to know what the customer's rules are and why the customer has those rules and what the market is, and decide how you need to adjust to your customer's rules. But to believe that customers are going to continue to shop with you if they're dissatisfied is highly unlikely.
Right.
Yeah, I believe the less rules, the better. At Tractor Supply, we got a sign that hangs over the checkouts that says satisfaction guaranteed, and then the magic words that it says all team members have the authority to do whatever it takes, which means, you know, we trust you, employees. Just do whatever it takes to make the customer right. In other words, there are no rules in terms of satisfying a customer at Tractor Supply, and I think that kind of empowerment leads you into a very solid relationship with customers.
And this online question from Tony: what if I'm a very small company and have a very few employees? And, you know, when I hear you talk about all this research, it sounds as though you've got a whole department that's doing that. So how can I make that work if I'm very small?
Go online to SurveyMonkey and take a look at what they offer, and you'll see that it takes a few hours by one person to do the research. So it is not complicated. It used to be. I mean, it used to be very complicated, very expensive, but that's now changed.
Okay. Other questions? What other questions do you have?
Well, in that case, we want to thank you all for being with us. We want to remind you again, it's July 17th. Jeff Smart, and it's all about the process of selecting good people. Bob Gordman, it's great to chat with you again. Thanks for joining us. Hope to see you this fall. And for everybody who's been on the call, thank you for joining us. And again, we'll see you July 17th. Thanks, everybody, and goodbye.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.